This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. It's easy to see the nation's universities as a positive force, educating young minds, producing research that furthers the human condition, and on a more practical level, serving as major employers in many communities. But Trinity College professor, author, and historian DeVarian Baldwin argues there's another side to the contemporary university, extreme power and significant influence over the shape and feel of our cities. In his recent book, In the Shadow of the Ivory Tower, How Universities Are Plundering Our Cities, he argues that universities heavily influence everything, from land use to housing costs to wages, in many American cities, often with negative implications for people and communities with less power. Dr. Baldwin will give a talk about his book at the University of Cincinnati this evening. He joins me now to talk about these important issues. Welcome, Dr. Baldwin.
Hey, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
We're grateful to have you here. Also joining me is University of Cincinnati Zane Miller Chair of Urban History, David Stradling. Thanks for being here, Dr. Stradling.
Thank you, Lucy. It's nice to be back.
The University of Cincinnati is a financial supporter of Cincinnati Public Radio. And if you have questions or comments, give us a call at 513-419-7100 or email talk at wvxu.org. So, DeVarian, start by talking with us about the public good paradox. I understand that's kind of how you've described this whole issue. Mm.
It's kind of the way I came into the story, actually, this public good paradox, because the presumption of higher education as being a public good is because it provides services that other public entities or government forces don't provide, i.e. education or research. And so in exchange for that service, the properties held by a college university are tax exempt. What I found, though, is that there is a public good paradox to this, because it's precisely the presumption that higher education is a nonprofit public good that gives them this tax exemption, which is actually the way in which these entities transfer public dollars into their private interest. In terms of today's what we call knowledge economy, pharmaceuticals, tech, software, military defense weaponry, that it's actually that, you know, that capacity of being a nonprofit actually allows them to be actually for profit. And so their tax exemption, which comes from being a nonprofit, actually provides a tax shelter for both the university and their private partners, private investors. And so that money that would normally go to things like public schools, infrastructure, roads, the electrical grid, those monies get funneled into the for-profit interests of the university. So this is the paradox I talk about in the book.
And talk to us a little bit more about the ways, all the different ways a university exerts power.
Sure. So I just want to be real quick up front, just to be fair, and you kind of laid this out as well, but I want to be clear about this, is that when we look at universities and what they bring to cities, bring to communities, you mentioned education, pure research, but also today now more applied research, things that can be monetized and generate jobs, and the big word we love to talk about, innovation. So those are things that universities can do, and they become magnets for investors, for young professionals, for tourism, you know, the commercial districts that universities bring. So those are things that they can do. But there's an underside to this. As universities and their medical schools and their centers become today's factories, our communities become their factory towns. And with that, there's a cost to those that live in the shadows. So as universities expand into communities that surround them, they raise housing costs above the means of those who would normally live there. As their medical facilities provide health services for surrounding communities, they become the largest healthcare provider. But they gear their health services towards boutique services like cancer research or cosmetic surgery or student needs, to the detriment of long-term residents. And then on top of that, as this wealth gets built up in these campus areas, these expansive campuses, they build out police forces to protect that. And we would think, okay, this is for the public good. You're making things safer. But what we find is a two-tier policing approach where there actually is very little policing that goes on campuses. And there's crime. And there's over-policing in the surrounding communities. And so this creates a two-tier policing system, an over-policing of the host communities, and an under-policing of the campuses. And a lot of this all is centered around trying to generate and protect the university brand, because that is what brings the wealth in terms of students, in terms of researchers, in terms of the for-profit research that happens there, in terms of the tourism that creates a certain kind of safety and a urban lifestyle that developers want to build next to or adjacent to. And so all of this is great on surface, but the problem is that this is a cost for the host communities that make these spaces available. They can't live there. Their healthcare is not being provided. They are offering the low-wage jobs in the cafeterias and the grounds crew at a below-living wage. And then all the wealth there is being surrounded by this police force that looks at these individuals and communities as a safety threat instead of as an asset. And so this is the new dynamic. This is the new kind of what we kind of call the new feudalism. The concentration of wealth in these university areas and the extraction of wealth from these host communities.
Well, that over-policing certainly will sound resonate with our listeners who remember the case of Samuel DuBose and former Cincinnati office, University of Cincinnati police officer Ray Tenzing. Mm-hmm. Dave, where do you think this is playing out locally?
Well, in Cincinnati, we've noticed it most in Avondale. You know, that's the most recent story with the expansion of what UC calls the Innovation Corridor, which was facilitated by a collaboration with Uptown Consortium and the City of Cincinnati to build that really important intersection, Interstate 71 and Martin Luther King. The creation of that intersection changed property values dramatically on all four corners there, two of which are in Avondale. And the whole goal of the university in supporting that that interchange was to allow new development there, some of which the university would occupy, some of which it wouldn't, but to create a synergy among both private researchers, but also other public researchers like NIOSH and, of course, the hospitals that are nearby. So we've seen a real transformation of that part of Southern Avondale. Lots of homes were demolished. A lot of this happened without a lot of public notice. And it speaks to a new type of expansion of UC's campus. A lot of the land is not owned and never will be owned by the university. But the university has joined what scholars call the growth machine. So it has collaborated with traditional developers and also development corporations like the Uptown Consortium to make certain that the research interests of the university have room to grow.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about the impact universities have on their communities with Trinity College professor, author, and historian DeVarian Baldwin and University of Cincinnati Zane Miller Chair of Urban History David Stradling. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100 or emailing talk@wvxu.org. We do have a caller on the line. Bob, thank you so much for calling. What is your question or comment?
Oh, I just wanted to say that, as I told the interviewer, I lived in Coryville from 1950 to 1962. I was three in 1950, so I'm old. But Coryville was a thriving neighborhood with business districts on Vine and Calhoun Street and on Jefferson Avenue. And if you read the papers from back in the later 60s, they keep saying it was a slum. It wasn't a slum. Mm. My sisters and I, we went to St. George Grade School, and, you know, it was a thriving neighborhood with stores and everything. And now we enjoyed living next to UC because of the football games and homecoming and all that. That was exciting. But they just kept tearing down everything. And you know, one of the excuses of St. George, they said, oh, well, we can't have a, you know, the church is going to close because there's no parishioners. Well, there weren't any parishioners because there was nowhere to live. Mm. They tore all the houses down. Mm-hmm. So it's really an example of a university, of larger institutions taking advantage of just small people. Mm. Thank you so much. Small homeowners.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for your call, Bob. I really appreciate that.
Okay. Thank you.
What do you think about that, DeVarian?
Yeah, what Bob speaks about is the act, and this is why I'm coming to deliver these comments for this evening at the talk tonight near campus, is that this is a national trend. What came out of my research is what I call the Smart Cities Lab research lab. And what we're doing, it started out as kind of information sharing, but because these issues are so dire right now and so urgent, it's become an advocacy group. And so I've been going across the country, Miami, New Haven, Connecticut, Southside Chicago, Berkeley, California, San Diego, talking about the same trends that Bob is talking about, where what happens when your community or your neighborhood becomes a campus. And the term I've kind of coined with this is the rise of when higher education takes control over the economic development and urban and governance, political governance of your community. It's what I call the rise of the university. Mm-hmm. So that all the interests, like, so it's not just about like the planning, the development, but it's about political decisions that are made in these neighborhoods first go through the university because their interests are primary, even in these adjacent neighborhoods. And so what Bob talks about, so housing, long-term, single-family residential housing gets moved out or priced out because all the new housing is organized around breaking up single-family homes into what's being called mini dorms, because you can get more money per square footage by filling a single-family home with five individual paying students, for example, or just a total gut process where you're taking out those homes and building up nice glass and steel, high-tech, upscale housing for full-paying students who can afford to pay that, just on the housing side. And so this is a national story. And so what I want to do in talking about the national story is for people to come tonight and to see to what degree does these national trends, do they fit with the Cincinnati story? And to what degree are there differences that we need to explore more deeply about the local conditions of Cincinnati? So I invite people to have that conversation about how these national trends are consistent and inconsistent.
Mm-hmm. We'll continue our discussion about the impact universities have on their communities in just a moment. And later in the show, we'll talk about a program the city of Cincinnati is using to spur the creation of more affordable housing. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're talking about the impact universities have on their communities with Trinity College professor, author, and historian DeVarian Baldwin and University of Cincinnati Zane Miller Chair of Urban History David Stradling. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. DeVarian, I want to focus on specifically the racial disparities in this phenomenon that we've been talking about. It sounds like a lot of communities that are affected most are communities of color. Can you talk to us about how that is playing out nationwide?
Yeah, for sure. So whether it's the University of Southern California in South Central, University of Chicago on the south side of Chicago, UPenn in West Philadelphia, University of Colorado at Denver and Auraria. These are all both public and private urban universities in historically Black and Latinx neighborhoods. Now, there's a history to that. We could talk about that if you want to. But in the present, this makes these communities, because of a history that linked racial population with, you know, diminished land values and decreased political power, for the university players, these neighborhoods are not just communities of color, but they are politically and economically ripe for exploitation and expansion, because there is less political pushback. The value of the neighborhoods economically is less, even for, you know, nice housing, good housing stock, good blocks. But because these are historically Black and brown neighborhoods, they can get them at a lower price. And so these neighborhoods become especially targeted for university expansion, policing, control, the rise of these universities. And so this is a popular trend that we're seeing. And so right now, when there's a popular conversation in communities, in university neighborhoods or communities, especially after the Black Summer of 2020, diversity, equity, and inclusion, or this racial reckoning. And what I've been arguing and talking about over the country is that, you know, you can't just talk about, in a racial reckoning, talk about a diversifying curriculum and bringing more faculty of color and, you know, renaming buildings that were once owned by, you know, that were named after slaveholders. University of Cincinnati, right? The Humanities Building. If you're in a historically black and brown neighborhood, that racial reckoning must also extend beyond the campus gates. How are you paying your black and brown workers at the cafeteria a living wage? How much affordable housing are you building with these new innovation corridors? What degree are you preserving job training or small businesses for black and brown communities in these new developments? You know, the tax exemption for your healthcare facilities comes with the requirement of providing indigent care for the surrounding communities. Are you actually doing that? And so these expansions and these developments are having a directly adverse impact on the black and brown communities that historically have surrounded these communities.
Dave, talk to us about UC's history along those lines in terms of the way it's interacted with communities of color.
Mm-hmm. Well, we alluded to it earlier with the shooting of Samuel DuBose, which I think was a real turning point for the university, thinking that it needed to, as DeVarian was saying, police farther away from its campus boundaries. And so that police officer was well away from campus and taking up work that I think nobody on campus would expect him to be doing. But it spoke to a trend about making certain that a wider area would be safe for students and using the stereotypes of race, policing certain people in a different way than they would on campus, which is exactly what DeVarian said. The surveillance of people off campus is extraordinary. And more recently, as I was saying about Avondale, I think more traditional kind of the type of urban renewal tactics that we used to see all going back into the 50s and 60s are still being used to, clear out land that that developers would like to increase in value. So we saw as that interchange was being built, lots of lots that just became nothing. A gasoline station that was demolished for nothing. An entire neighborhood that was demolished for nothing has replaced it. Eventually it will. But, so the idea is to clear out these folks. And that is just to not see black and brown people, as DeVarian is saying, on the street corner was, I think, really part of the intention, right? That we don't want potential developers, investors to see black people at the Marathon, at the corner of Martin Luther King in Reading. And the only way you can make that happen is to demolish the Marathon station.
DeVarian, this has been an issue with other nonprofits locally, too. I'm thinking of our Children's Hospital and surrounding support services. I wonder what your thoughts are on that. And do you think universities have a unique responsibility here?
Yeah, I mean, so you're right. This is not just a university phenomena, but it speaks to the larger, the fall of factories in our economy. And we should pause to spend a moment on that, is that with the fall of factories are going to moving to the, they never go away. They move to the global south because we all have clothes on, right? So they still exist. But in the replacement of them in the urban, in the global north, are these information, white collar industries like nonprofits, hospitals, we call them meds and eds, universities and a parallel housing development, healthcare development, research for, like I mentioned before, the knowledge economy of pharmaceuticals and military work and things of that nature. This is a larger economic conversation, a shift in the economy. And so the hospitals are a part of that larger conversation. But when it comes to universities, there is a special responsibility because universities are, they self-promote themselves. They self-promote as being problem solvers, solving the world's most difficult problems. And yet they fail to look at their hand in creating problems in their own backyard. Mm-hmm. And so for me, unlike Amazon, a university has a greater onus to not do harm on top of a hospital. Mm-hmm. On top of that, universities, whether they're public or private, their existence is predicated on being given a state charter for their existence. So the state charter requires a public investment and a service to the public for their very existence, which for me instigates or provokes a greater responsibility to the public that surrounds the campuses.
We have another caller on the line. Bill, thank you so much for calling. What is your question or comment?
Yeah, I just wanted to speak to a kind of a parallel issue, which is historically black colleges and universities, and some, which are sometimes called, I guess, predominantly black institutions. And one of the things that strikes me about Cincinnati is it really needs an HBCU or PBI. And you look at places like Atlanta and North Carolina, where there's just big concentrations of HBCUs, and they're economic development drivers in Atlanta. There's five HBCUs in Atlanta. There's like 11 or 12 statewide in North Carolina, and now you see large-scale manufacturers and tech companies beginning to move, particularly North Carolina, and they're citing their cooperation with A&T State, which is the largest HBCU in the country, to generate, to create the STEM talent that's needed for these companies. And I just think it's a real missing piece in Cincinnati, and it would, I think it speaks to this issue, because those institutions tend to be, have been in predominantly black communities for 100 years, and you don't tend to have those kind of tensions. And also, they're economic development drivers.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Bill. What do you think about that, Tavarian?
Yeah, I mean, some people have asked me before, so what do you think about, like, Howard? Or what do you think about, you know, other historically black colleges, Xavier in New Orleans, and what they're, are they doing similar things in these communities? You know, that's the elephant in the room. And sometimes they are, but a lot of times they're not. And there are various reasons why that is. Some of these schools would like to be doing some of the same things we're talking about, but they have been grossly underfunded. I mean, for example, in the state of Maryland, historically black colleges just won a $700 million lawsuit because of the ways in which the state, these are state black colleges, have been grossly underfunded by the state of Maryland. And so this is a national story that they can't do the same kind of things because they don't have the revenue, the wealth. But at the same time, there is a certain kind of proximity between black colleges and the communities that would be making it more difficult for them to engage in the same kind of callous, rapacious development that has no impact on the community in a positive way. So I think that the caller is right on that point. But I still think that whether historically black colleges or predominantly white institutions, there needs to be a greater level of public oversight over university-generated development. That today, when these institutions do this kind of work, it's just like, well, they're a university. What I say, you know, in other places, we're enamored by the myth of the schoolhouse. We believe, oh, they're doing good things. They're an educator. They're economic driver. Let them do what they want to do. But in all of that, no matter black college or predominantly white institution, there must be public oversight over the kind of development and the kind of policing and the kind of behavioral control that happens and the health service provisions that happen when universities become the primary economic driver. And that's the warning, the bellwether that I'm trying to provide in this conversation. No matter who it is, if universities are going to be the main economic engine of your city, it's got to come with some sort of public oversight. I keep saying that, but I just want to keep saying that. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really important because you've seen some of the same kind of dangers, not with Howard University's main campus, but its medical school, which is better endowed, is moving into the historically black neighborhoods in ways that resemble what's going on that I talk about with predominantly white schools in my book. Mm. So just as a warning. But this, you know, when the PPE money came out, real quickly, I'm sorry. When the PPE money came from the federal government, while some predominantly white schools were dumping that money into their endowment and just hoarding it, to the credit of black colleges, to the point of the caller, they were using that money to reduce tuition. Mm. So there is this historical mandate of service that these historically black colleges have that predominantly white schools don't necessarily share.
Yeah. Did you want to add to that?
Yeah, then? I just wanted to add. I do think it's interesting that Bill mention historically black colleges and universities because it speaks to the fact that schools like the University of Cincinnati have not served the black community well. Mm. And as much as UC has, I think, struggled to do so, you know, since the civil rights movement in the 60s, we've not figured out a clear path forward. And I will say part of that has to do with the rhetoric may be right, but the investment's simply not there. I mean, if our Office of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion were as large as our Office of Innovation, we would be serving the black community better.
Mm. Great point.
Thank you so much for that call, Bill. Well, we're running short on time. There's so much more to talk about, but this will encourage people.
Come out and have a conversation.
Yes, exactly. I've been talking with Trinity College professor, author, and historian DeVarian Baldwin and University of Cincinnati Zane Miller Chair of Urban History David Stradling. Dr. Baldwin's lecture begins at 7 p.m. today at UC's Probasco Auditorium on Clifton Avenue, and there's a panel discussion at 7:45 afterwards with a panel you shouldn't miss. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thanks so much for
having
us.
Up next, we'll discuss a City of Cincinnati program that's helping to create more affordable housing. This is Cincinnati Edition.